The third case for today is United States v. Hennis. This is argument on a motion, so we don't have an appellant or appellee. We have the movant or proponent of the motion, and we have the government in opposition to the motion. Argument will be limited to 10 minutes to a side, and I see you have reserved time for rebuttal. Okay. Is the movant ready? Is the government ready? Please proceed.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Tim Burrows. Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Carey and I represent the movant, Master Sergeant Timothy Hennis. Capital cases are amongst the most complex, long-lasting, and specialized cases we try in our system. The case of Timothy Hennis is certainly no exception to that principle. Cases like these require counsel that are ready for the task, require a team that are ready for the task. And that is why I believe in this court's most recent decision in a capital case, United States versus Akbar, it noted that it remains vigilant as to the quality of representation provided service members in capital cases. I'm before the court today to ask it to exercise that vigilance and ensure that Master Sergeant Hennis receives the appellate defense team he deserves on this capital appeal. That team should consist of learned counsel, a mitigation specialist, and a fact investigator.
Hey, counsel, the problem is at Akbar we made that statement, right, upon the heels of saying that we were not going to do what you are asking us to do here today, which is basically follow the federal rule and the ABA guidelines, right? And we were looking at Akbar in the context of whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel, right?
Correct.
So we've said for a number of years, basically forever, that Strickland is the standard, and that absent a statute, right, that our hands are tied. We're not going to get involved in the personnel decisions of the different services, right? You're tracking thus far. Yeah. So all of what you say in your brief was presented to the Military Justice Review Group, right? And on the heels of that, right, they caused an amendment to be undertaken to Article 70 and Article 37 to change the qualifications for in capital cases, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And in those instances, you would get one learned counsel and a second counsel, right?
As far as counsel go, yes, Your Honor.
Yes, okay. And even with all that information, right, the rule becomes effective 2 years from now,
A year from now, Your Honor.
Right? And even then, it specifically says it doesn't apply to cases that have already been tried, right? So you're asking us to do what Congress presented with all the information that's in your brief explicitly chose not to do. Do you understand the problem?
I understand your position, Your Honor. However, I think there's another way to view this. The question of learned counsel is a question of effective assistance of counsel. It is a Sixth Amendment issue. And we assess the performance of counsel under the Sixth Amendment by reasonable actions based on reasonable investigation. And we determine reasonable in light of the prevailing professional norms. And I submit to the court that the Military Justice Act of 2016, which was preceded by the forwarding of those recommendations by the Secretary of Defense, requiring appellate counsel to be learned in capital cases, represent a shift in the prevailing norms. Before, it was just the federal system that required learned counsel, then we had the military commissions, and now it is us. We are not alone anymore in this, and I think the Military Justice Act of 2016 should be understood in light of the Sixth Amendment and how it changes it. That is the first thing I'd like to say. The second thing is to consider it already as an authorization. While the act itself may purport to only take effect at the latest 2 years from its enactment. There's nothing limiting the executive to put it into play earlier. And I think when Congress says, we think this is important as a general matter, and it's something that affects the substantive right of someone who's accused of a crime, there's no reason not to be vigilant in acting earlier.
But, it's also explicitly excludes cases preferred before the effective date.
And the problem, again, counsel, is not a lack of sympathy, and I do have some words for the government, okay? But it was calls to mind, this what was, I don't know if it was in a concurrence or what it was in Chronic, where the Supreme Court says it's not what is prudent or appropriate, but what is compelled by statute or the Constitution that we are concerned with. Okay, and so I understand your point, right? And one would wonder, given the expense of capital litigation, why the government would risk the specter of us determining down the road, right, that there was ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, right, because they did not provide the level of assistance that you said was required, right? So one can wonder at that, and again, we will probably have questions for the government about that fact. But it doesn't change our mandate, which is the Supreme Court has said Strickland is a standard, remains a standard for effective assistance of counsel and effective assistance of counsel. And unless we have statute or unless there's a constitutional issue, right, we're basically, that's where I think at least we're stuck.
And the proposal I would make to you, Your Honor, is that the passage of the Military Justice Act of 2016 helps demonstrate what is now the prevailing norm in our practice. And there's another source that we can look to, which is Army Regulation 27-10, in which the Judge Advocate General of the Army decided that when we have capital cases, and I submit to the court, it is just as clear for trial and appeal that there should be experienced, qualified counsel.
And I think that they definitely are concerned with experienced, qualified counsel. I don't know what you make of the fact that the Army itself has interpreted its regulation not to completely apply, except in a limited respect to appellate. What do you say to the government's argument that just as it would, if it was an admin law sort of issue, that we give some deference to the agency's interpretation of its own rule? Why wouldn't that be the same here, that we give some deference to the Army's interpretation of its own regulation when it's not unequivocally stating what you argue that it states?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. My answer.
You may answer the question.
I think there are two reasons to discount that interpretation of the regulation. The first is it's not reasonable. The plain language it says this applies to all Army cases in which an accused is charged with an offense that could result in the death penalty. In any case after preferral, talks about defense teams. It does not talk about trial defense teams, and they could have easily stated that. So,
but the person that it has assigning, right, the two counsel and the other things, is not the person that would assign an appellate counsel. It's the person that would be assigning trial counsel.
In paragraph, the final paragraph that talks about continuity of counsel on appeal, it doesn't reference the chief of TDS, the Trial Defense Service. It references the assigning
right, that's,
defense
that, right, that's a part for continuity of counsel and that it's going to take a long time, et cetera, et cetera.
But it also discusses an entire defense team, Your Honor.
Okay. You have, leaving aside whether it applies at one level or both, the regulation by its own words says it creates no rights, creates no causes of action, and is basically advisory only. I mean, if we take the Secretary of the Army at face value, where does that leave you?
Well, I assume that the Secretary of the Army and the proponent of the regulation, when they offer suggested advice, they expect it to be employed. And this is
suggested advice, but it's a suggestion. It's saying it'd be nice if you did this. The Secretary of the Army certainly has the authority, I would think, to require it. He elected not to.
Well, I would submit that the Secretary of Defense has expressed desire for this to be a requirement, and that's why that recommendation was forwarded.
Well, and how did the Secretary of Defense express that?
By adopting the recommendations of the Military Justice Review Group.
Right, which then Congress dealt with in its own way. And we're back to point one.
And I would submit to the court that helped shape our understanding of what the prevailing norms of practice.
Thank you. Government may argue. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, no, I... Before you even start your argument, this is not a game, right? This is not a game. We have the state standards for appointment of counsel in death penalty cases that in almost every instance includes a capital litigation person that's learned, that has some experience at least in capital litigation, and that certainly has litigation, criminal appellate litigation, of some number of years. We have the ABA standards, same thing. We have the statutory change that we know is coming, right? We have someone that has been convicted of premeditated murder of three individuals that has now at third trial, third appeal, a somewhat novel issue, meaning that even though it's not saying how we decide it, but I mean there is a novel issue, which is that he was tried in state court twice and now was tried in the military justice system. And the government's response to our show cause order, which should have, I would have thought, telegraphed to you that we were concerned by the level of experience and the other burdens upon the defense appellate team, instead of taking our concerns seriously, sends us an answer basically saying it's not our damn problem, we're not the people, we would never deign to tell the defense agent, whatever it is, the detailing authority for the defense on what to do, leaving in a motion that has not one, not two, not three, but four government lawyers listed on the motion, right? So as I said to the appellant's counsel, it is clear that the statute says what it says, but it's also clear that you're playing a very dangerous game because down the road, if we determine that there is ineffective assistance of appellate counsel because they have filed motions saying we're not up to the task, it's a very strange position for the government to be in. Do you understand me?
I do. I believe I understand your concerns, Judge Ryan. I hope to address them the best I can in my argument today. Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Sam Landis, and along with Captain Catherine Parnell, I represent the United States. This court should deny the appellant's motion for three reasons. First, because appellant is not legally entitled to counsel with any certain attributes. Second, because it is the chief of the Defense Appellate Division who is empowered to decide who is specifically detailed to appellant's case. And third, because the non-lawyer resources appellant has requested, appellant has not shown the necessity required.
So are you saying that TJAG and the chief of PPTO doesn't have any say in this? They couldn't address this problem as outlined by Judge Ryan?
Certainly not, Your Honor. What I'm saying is the regime that TJAG has
set. So you're saying TJAG could fix this problem?
TJAG could. TJAG is...
And you've got a new TJAG?
We do, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so I guess my question is, since people often look at the military justice system and say, wow, it sure doesn't seem very just to me, right? But you're saying that because the law doesn't require you to do anything now, and because DAD is the person responsible, that it's outside the bounds of fairness for the TJAG or for the government to suggest to the TJAG that they perhaps take some action in line with what the defense appellant is requesting. Because that's a very different question, and it's too bad. Which you said you were going to address my concerns, and all you did was reiterate them.
Yes, Your Honor. The government, in the regime that is set up currently, the government can only control one thing, and that is the pool of resources available to the Defense Appellate Division. And what the government has provided in that pool of resources, which the Defense Appellate Division can then draw from, and that's the discretion that is dedicated to the Defense Appellate Division.
In the pool of resources, who there is learned counsel in the capital litigation sense?
None is learned counsel in the sense that the federal civilian system uses. what the government has provided, though.
So, and I think I'm correct about this, before going to DOD, wasn't Dwight Sullivan, and I'm not suggesting that he be removed from DOD, didn't the Air Force hire a civilian solely to do capital litigation in the person of Dwight Sullivan?
I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you what the Army has
done. I know the answer to it, but it's not in the record.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I know what the Army has done. What the Army has done is provide, in that pool of resources, 16 counsel that PPTO described as competent and capable of representing appellant, and Lieutenant Colonel Carrier, an 05 and an 03 position with the title of Chief of Complex and Capital Litigation, an accomplished military justice practitioner, a former military judge.
Counsel, before you go further there, let me just recite the facts as I understand them from the record. And you tell me if I misunderstand the record.
Yes, sir.
In terms of Lieutenant Colonel Carrier, who you're just referencing, he is not prosecuted or defended and accused in a capital case. He has only limited experience in capital appeals. He serves as the Chief of Capital and Complex Litigation and thus could not substantially dedicate himself to this case. Then we've got Captain Burroughs, has never participated in a capital case, has only about a year of appellate experience, has a caseload of 27 cases, and has never contested a case before a panel of members. So you can go on about how this looks good, but how do the facts here reflect upon the resources that are being put forth by the government in terms of the appellant's rights to be properly represented?
We disagree with none of those facts, Your Honor. What is important to understand, though, is that with the regime that is set up, which is to protect the chief of the Defense Appellate Division in her decisions in make of who to detail to a specific case, those are decisions that she's made. So
are we playing a morbid sense of chicken here, where the chief of DAD is saying, I'm going to appoint these people in order to extort resources from elsewhere?
We certainly hope not, Your Honor.
Well, why can't TJAG fix this problem?
TJAG is certainly empowered by Article 70 to fix this problem.
Okay, thank you.
What TJAG has done with his power under Article 70 is set up a regime designed to ensure fairness, which is to give to one officer, the Defense Appellate Division Chief, the complete discretion to detail specific counsel to specific cases.
Complete discretion to detail somebody that's got 27 cases?
Yes.
Yikes!
Yes, Your Honor. So what has occurred here
is... I'm the head of DAD, and remember, I came from another service, so, you know, sometimes I get my Army acronyms wrong or so. But what you're saying is Chuck Petey, or his predecessor, said, here is a pool of manpower, best I can come up with. Head of DAD, go to it.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And that's the step that in the current regime the government now controls. What goes into the pool of resources? What happens from there?
Well, the government controls. The government is a magnificent blob. Who in the government, the TJAG or DAD or somebody else?
TJAG as to the pool of resources.
Right.
The next step is where the head of DAD.
Right, right. But the ultimate pool comes out of the TJAG.
Correct. Yes,
can the head of Defense Appellate, who you contend has this pool of resources, if she says, I've looked at my pool of resources, and I don't have the right ones, I want you to reassign three of my counsel out of here and bring me in three experienced, learned counsel. Can she do that?
She could. She could request that. She has requested.
But she can't make it happen, can she?
She cannot make it happen. Right.
Okay.
She did request from the convening authority, right, she did request resources to hire people, didn't she?
She did, yes, sir.
Okay, and they said no.
Correct.
That's right. And... So I guess you've heard the expression, you know, you can win the battle and lose the war, right? And I think I made it pretty clear what I feel about the state of the law and our ability to do anything. But you do understand that the concerns that the appellant is raising at this point about the standards, right, you know, they don't go away, right? The fact that we can't do anything now doesn't make this whole thing go away. Right. And so I would question whether a DAD who's being asked or being told by her two appellate defense counsel that they're not competent to represent this capital case, that a DAD that nonetheless keeps them, and a TJAG that keeps them representing a capital case, is probably not doing their job very well.
We prefer to not second-guess the Chief of Defense Appellate Division for the reason that it could harm the perception of fairness and actual fairness. The TJAG has...
You understand that my perception of fairness when I get a government motion signed by four attorneys, I'm like thinking, are you crazy? Right? You said you have four attorneys listed on your government motion.
That's correct.
You're telling me that it's not, there's nothing that you can do when the government is the government, right? The government is the convening authority that said no to the resources. The government is the TJ. The government is the DAD. The government is you, right? And so I absolutely agree that you cannot tell the DAD who to detail. I absolutely disagree that you, the government, meaning all those other people I just mentioned, are helpless to do anything.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
What I would like to highlight, though, is what the government has done, and that is to specifically, among other resources, provide the Chief of DAD with Colonel Carrier, a counsel who would meet the conditions in Chapter 28 of AR 27-10 had he been assigned as the lead counsel in this case. That could have occurred, and the Chief of DAD is empowered to do that. She has not. And the government is not, the regime that is set up, which tries to balance the Article 70 duties of TJAG with giving appropriate counsel to appellant and with the perception of fairness. Under that regime, the government does not interfere with or second guess.
Well, I understand, but the government includes all those other people that I talked about, and it would seem to me that if that's what the Chief of DAD has chosen to do with the resources, that we need a new Chief of DAD.
Understood, Your Honor. Turning briefly to the non-lawyer assets that appellant has requested, appellant has not made the showing of necessity as to those assets that he's required to under the law. He asked for a new mitigation expert to review the work of the old mitigation expert. It's very similar to the request that was made to this court in United States versus Tharp. That's a request that failed in this court, the idea that a new expert would simply review the work of an old expert. As to a fact investigator, appellant writes in his motion that investigator...
Counsel, can I ask you a question there? Is this court the proper forum to decide that issue?
In United States versus Gray, this court certainly indicated that it could be. Certainly, you might require that the appellant exhaust other resources within the government before then. Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. Pending any further questions from the court?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does the movement have rebuttal?
Counsel, I'm concerned about how we would structure relief. Would we say, it is hereby ordered the Judge Advocate General of the Army provide an additional $271,300 and let the Chief of Defense Appellant decide what to do with the money? And if she decides she's not going to hire anybody else, that we got to hold the government responsible for that? I mean, how do we solve the problem?
Your Honor, I see...
I don't know how we get in the military personnel business, what I'm saying. I agree it looks awful that you don't have somebody that knows what the heck they're doing. Although, having heard you, I would like to have you as my counsel, but that's a different thing. But still, what do we do?
So I can propose three approaches.
Okay.
To this, Your Honor. The first is the one we're asking for. Order the Army to provide learned counsel, mitigation specialist, and a fact investigator.
Under what authority, though? I mean, there's no authority.
Well, I'd submit that there are two authorities. One is the inherent authority of the court to ensure that those who come before it seeking justice are appropriately represented. And I do submit, I realize there may be a difference of opinion, but I believe at this point the Sixth Amendment, as it's understood for the prevailing professional norms, it is now clear within our own practice that learned counsel and an appropriate defense team are now the norm. I think this court could make that decision, and if it's wrong, within a year, it's going to be beyond it'll be moot, essentially, based on the statute.
But you understand my concern, which is that presented with all that information and given the opportunity to take that into account, make it effective now, make it retroactive to any case pending on appeal, Congress elected not to make that decision.
I would.
I'm sorry, but you said you had two other points, so I'll let you.
Yeah, and I do understand that point. I would take a different interpretation of the retroactivity provision. I think that could be construed as not applying to substantive rights, but perhaps I could brief that later if the court's interested. The other two options that this court could take would be, first, just abate the proceedings until the Judge Advocate General and the Army decide to provide appropriate counsel. This court doesn't have to review it now. It can take time. We want this review. I mean, my client is on death row. He does not have the luxury of waiting for things to happen. So this is not our ideal solution, but...
But aren't we then turning this into a court of equity rather than a court of law? Us jumping in and saying, we're going to abate the proceedings here out of just a sense of fairness?
I believe the law would support it, Your Honor. I understand the concern about this becoming an equitable remedy, and so I'd argue for the first one. I think the constitutional right is clear from our position. The third option that we have is the federal courts, they typically assign these things through their own resources. I won't venture to say whether that's something the CAF can do, but it's an option.
Say again, what?
But they have a statute. They have 18 U.S.C. 3005, right, which you reference, right?
Yes, sir.
Gives them, I mean, they're not only authorized to, they're required to, upon request, assign not one but two counsel, one of which must be learned, right? I mean, I appreciate your concerns, and I hope that the government appreciates our concerns. And the fact that we can't do anything now does not mean that if, in fact, the appellate assistance is ineffective, right, which you're certainly making a record for that, that they don't lose the war down the road, right? But I understand that's not helpful to you today.
I understand that, Your Honor. And see, my time is getting close. I would like to briefly discuss the appointment of a mitigation specialist, if I may.
Why is that something that we would look at now?
Well, in our brief, we identify 7 to 8 obvious questions that we have not been able to address. The qualifications of a mitigation specialist.
Well, counsel, you're over time, and I don't want to hear 7 or 8 reasons.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may just give you one.
Give me one.
It is a question of reasonable necessity, which this court can address. And if we look at the opinion in Akbar, I mean, a mitigation specialist was recognized as an indispensable member of the defense team throughout all capital proceedings.
Thank you.
In terms of the fact specialist, and again, I don't know that this is something we would be looking at, but did you raise the issue about the newly discovered, the exculpatory evidence that the government brought to your attention?
Yes, sir.
Was that part of your motion that you made to the CCA?
It was, Your Honor. Thank you.
And I think that they just said it's denied for now. They didn't preclude you from coming back and further developing your motion and asking them again, did they?
I'll be honest with you, I cannot remember the exact holding on that point.
It was denied for now or something like that, but I could be wrong. Which I guess they can't say denied forever, no matter what happens. But
thank you.
Thank you. Cases, the motion is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Court is in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Court stays in recess until 9:30.